Tim Smith was a successful music composer and producer in the UK, and then he gave it all away and went to Cornwall. While he was in Cornwall, Tim pushed through a door and he discovered a completely wild and overgrown garden estate that had just been left forgotten and untouched for nearly a century. Tim Smith restored these fabulous gardens, known now as the Lost Gardens of Heligan, to their former glory, and he opened them to the public so that everybody could enjoy them. Then Tim Smith embarked on an even more ambitious project. He was inspired by Arthur Conan Doyle's Lost World to create a place, he said, where the world's bounty was gathered together in the biggest greenhouse in the world. This became the Eden Project, two massive domes nestled into the side of an old quarry. One dome contains a rainforest world and the other is a Mediterranean habitat. A visitor to the Eden Project commented, "It really looks like someone saw a place in a dream and then built it." The Eden Project and the Lost Gardens of Heligan have become two of the most massively popular tourist attractions in the UK. I spoke to Tim Smith at WOM Adelaide recently, in front of a live audience, and I began by asking him how a pig changed his life.
I gave up the music industry. I moved to Cornwall because I didn't really know what I wanted to do, but I didn't want to be in London. I then got desperate. I didn't know what I was going to do as a career that was not music. A friend gave me a pig. I really liked the pig. The pig was called Horace. He was a black pig, and he liked to come into the kitchen and warm his ass against the arga, and I talked to him. I talked to him a lot, and then eventually I realized he was lonely, so I got Doris. So I had Doris and Horace, and eventually they discovered each other, and they made beautiful music. And then one day in November of 1990, there were 13 little baby black pigs. So I decided that obviously this was a sign. It was a sign that I was meant to have a rare breed park. Obviously. So I went to find some land where I could have a rare breed park. So I found some land where I could have a rare breed park, and I went to see the guy who owned the land that I wanted to have a rare breed park on, and he gave me a very hot cup of coffee. Now, that was where my very sensitive lips changed my life, because he told me immediately I couldn't have the land to have a rare breed park. But during the course of the small talk, I mentioned that I'd been an archaeologist. And he said, "Crikey, you're an archaeologist." He said, "I've just inherited the estate next door. And I'm told that there's wonderful things under the overgrowth. Would you like to come and have a look at it?" And the following day, I found myself cutting myself into a garden with a big machete. And the rest, as they say, is history, because I fell in love with that and decided that I was meant to restore this garden called Heligan, which we then called the Lost Gardens of Heligan.
Tell me about this process of discovery, though, how you actually found your way into the garden and what you saw when you got in there.
It is extraordinary, really, because it feels like a romantic confection with the passage of time, but imagine you have arrived at a place that is completely overgrown, where the laurels are probably as wide as a man's arms can reach like that, and there's brambles and ivy weaving through all of them, and you've got to imagine that perhaps 6 weeks before that there'd been a hurricane in Cornwall in which just about every single major tree had been blown over. So you arrived in a landscape that was bramble and laurel, cutting our way through, and eventually we came to a walled garden. So you've got to imagine a wall literally as tall as that awning, and you just come to it, and in the middle of that wall is a door, and the door is very slightly ajar. You know the sort of thing, the rusted hinges, the paint peeling, and light just coming through a chink. And I opened the door, I pushed it open with my shoulder, and I just fell hopelessly in love with this place, because probably double the length of this wall was a vinery, you know, for growing grapes, vines. But all the wood had rotted out long ago, and the glass was just hanging in the brambles and catching the light. And I cut my way in gingerly, and there was this moment, it's as fresh as if it was yesterday, where I caught a glimpse of a nail in the plaster, and there was a tiny pair of scissors hanging off it through a hole of the, you know, put the fingers through, which are vine scissors. And the moment I saw them, my eyes started to pick up all over the place the tools that were just lying there everywhere, you know. And it was as if someone had said tea time, they'd all gone, but no one had come back. They just left it. But it had this feeling of an unresolved moment. And as I say, I fell in love with the place and decided I would change my life and restore those gardens. And I think everybody needs, I think maybe it's a question of age at a certain point, you need to seize your life in that particular way to have a sense that that was what you wanted to do and just grab it. And I've never regretted it.
It sounds like, as you say, quite like a fable almost. It's also a little bit like Great Expectations, in a way, Miss Havisham's house, where the clocks have stopped. How long had those tools been lying there, abandoned?
Probably since the end of 1915, because all of the garden staff had volunteered for the First World War by the end of 1915, and more than two-thirds of them would then die. And the chap that owned the stately home was so desolate because of that, that he didn't ever want to return to the house, and the whole place was just shut up.
So the First World War had come along, and nearly all the workers had been killed in France. France and Belgium, and that was that. And it just out of sheer heartache, it had been stopped as a snapshot in time.
Well, the house had also been used as he'd given the house over to be a shell shock hospital during the First World War, but he never returned, and the house would eventually be turned into flats, but they'd fenced off the gardens, so the gardens had just gone slowly to sleep. I mean, there were hundreds and hundreds of trees growing through it. All the glass houses were down. But the moment, I think, which was most transformative was when we started excavating. We went into one of the outbuildings, which was the Thunderbox room, the toilet. And when we cleared out the slates that had fallen down, and they were gutted. You've got to imagine a building that's been gutted and everything's fallen in. So as we took everything out, the plaster became revealed. And we could see that in the plaster, people had written in pencil. And when we sort of used magnifying glasses on it, it said, "Come ye not here to sleep nor to slumber." And it was dated really rather eerily August 1914. And all of the then garden staff had signed their names under it. The next time you see most of those names is on the war memorial in the three local hamlets.
That's almost unbearably poignant. That is, "Come ye not here to sleep nor to slumber." It's a call to labour, a call to action. It must have felt like it was a call to you.
Yeah, except it was in a toilet.
So what's the story of this estate? How was it built? How did it come to be once be a kind of the beautiful thing that it was way back when?
But what's really quite interesting, I mean, one of the only good things I can say about aristocracy is that they do have a long view. So they do things like plant trees and shelter belts and do things with a very long term, which I think would be great if politicians could do. These estates were also pretty much self-sustaining, except in the luxuries. I mean, at Heligan, the only thing that was imported other than luxury goods was coal, when coal was needed for the boilers from the mid-1800s. That's about it.
Were the gardens there self-sustaining? Was that the purpose of them, to provide produce for the manor house and the people who lived and worked on the estate?
Yeah, there was a home farm, and there are four walled gardens and a big productive garden, which was planted serially and in crop rotation, but also to make sure that the ripening of the crops was so that you had food all the year round. And also a very sophisticated mechanism for planting fruit on north-facing and south-facing walls so that they were ripening later, and selecting fruit as well that would not only ripen later, but that would store. So what we did when we restored the gardens was to try and collect all the original fruit, and no one quite knew what had been there. And I hit on the idea of using a metal detector, and I picked up all the original copper, zinc plant name labels, which we found. We found almost the complete collection, which we then washed with soapy water, and then rub olive oil into it, and the Indian ink and the olive oil react, and you can read it as clearly as if it was written yesterday. It's brilliant. So the collection you see at Heligan is the best collection. I think I'm boasting, but I think it's true. The best collection of heritage vegetables in Europe.
Did you have photos of the estate as it once was to use as a guide to how you wanted the estate to end up?
I'd love to imagine that I was such a thinker. No, it was an adventure. I've always liked the idea of doing things which can't finish. One of the things I hated when I was in the music industry was you'd start a song and then finish it. And I always felt sad. And I think the idea of always traveling and never arriving actually pleases me very much. That's why I want to do big things, because then you don't have to finish. And then if you're in charge, no one knows when it's finished, because it's you that decides where it is.
Did you want to return Heligan to a functioning estate, or did you want it to sort of be more like a museum or a theme park of these lost trades?
I think I wanted it to be many things, most importantly, I wanted it to be a place where people could get a respite from the noise of the background noise of the world outside, and get a sense of place. It's a very romantic place. It sounds like a marketing tool to say it's the most romantic garden in the world, but most people that go there say they think it's the most romantic place they've ever been. If you were to ask me the single thing I'm proudest of in terms of end result, it would be that more than 400 people, since we've opened the gardens, have chosen to have their ashes scattered there. That's very humbling, because you realise what that teaches you is that you're no more than a steward at a moment in time, and you've revealed a place that other people feel is important, and that's great.
Why did you want to bring people in to have a look at the place before you'd finished restoring it?
Because most people want to be part of an adventure. The idea of passively coming and ogling someone else's heroics is profoundly dull. We find that most of the people who became friends of Heligan in the start remain friends to this day. And that's why when we opened Eden Project, we decided we would do the same. We would open it before it was finished. It had two functions. One is that an awful lot of people loved the idea of seeing all the work going on. And the other was that anybody working there wasn't going to be leaning on a spade with 500,000 people looking at them.
You certainly wanted it to be educational. But what's your approach to that? Do you sort of want to put the beauty and the pleasure at first and then find the educational aspect flows from that? What's your thinking on that like, Tim?
Beauty must always come first. Beauty and joy, because once you've got beauty and joy, education follows very easily. It's very trite, actually. I mean, I'm aware that as I said that, that's a very trite thing to say, but I think, for example, if I move on to, say, Eden, the things I get more letters about are the quality of the binding on the bamboo handrails than we get about the biomes. People love the detail that is life-affirming. I don't know what it is. It's like your favourite records have got a really nice twist in them, haven't they? There's something that you know someone loved this. And I think people forget that we're creatures. That's all we are, creatures. And the things that move us are not massive, sort of fascistic, big things. The Eden Project, or Heligan per se, doesn't move you. What moves you is a handwritten plant label. It is the idea that someone bothered to tie the onions in a nice way. That someone bothered to choose a table that was nice to have a cup of tea on, or a mug that was good. The bigness is actually a male distraction. I really feel that now. The older I get, the more I realise how much is vanity.
How do the locals in Cornwall feel about the Lost Gardens of Heligan?
I think that the people of Cornwall love the Lost Gardens of Heligan. I mean, we have 350,000 people a year come, and a lot of them are Cornish. And we have... my favourite thing about Heligan is that we have more gardeners there today than we did in the days of the Victorians. In the days when it is supposed to be very unhip to employ lots and lots of people, because labour, of course, is a luxury, we find, actually, the more quality labour we employ, the more people love the place we got, because they've got more people to talk to, and it's better and better and better. It's cool.
Having had such this key role in instigating the gardens, what gives you the most pleasure from it now that it's open and when you're in the place?
Is knowing that people go there and fall in love there, and people have their ashes scattered there, and people have moments that are their private moments. I love meeting people who have made it theirs in their imagination. And I don't get a sense of ownership, I just get this tremendous sense of pleasure that we had the privilege of doing something which has been a stage on which other people are making their lives. And with every person that falls in love there, with every set of ashes are scattered there, the plates of time get thicker, the meaning of the place gets deeper. And that gives me a lot of satisfaction.
Is it lovely to see kids running around the place, just taking delight in what they see and what they encounter?
Well, one of the funniest things, though, is that we put in a bridge, a 60-metre-long rope bridge that is quite dangerous in the way it swings. The old people like it the most. I don't know what it is. I'm obviously not old enough, but you see the 70 or 80-year-olds, they make straight for the bridge. It's a test. I think it's a bit like that thing I'm told that when you get to about 75, you try, when no one's watching, to put on socks by standing on one foot. I think it's got that kind of same sort of kind of thrill and excitement. You know?
Your mum was English, your dad was Dutch. You were a music producer for many years. How were you introduced to music as a child, Tim?
I used to lift the lid on my grandmother's grand piano, and I would put my foot down on the sustain pedal and bang every single note, and then I'd put my head to the soundboard, and I would just wait and wait and wait until the noise turned into this beautiful chord. If you've never done that, it explains something very profound. Do that. It is really weird how the noise, all the notes playing together, suddenly creates this enormous, beautiful chord right at the end. And it then makes you think very differently about chaos, where the chaos is something absolutely beautiful that you just haven't understood yet. It's very profound. If you'd ask me what is probably the most profound hour of my life in terms of concentrating, it was when a friend said to me, would I give him an hour to change my life? And he pegged out 1 meter square in a field. And he says, I want you to look at that square as if the devil himself is about to come out of it. And it's really interesting when you do that, because after a while, you start to see all the stems of grass. As opposed to grassness, they become the stems, and then you see the insects, and then all the insects. And suddenly, you realize you've got this entire world that you just had never noticed before. And it has two things. One is profound, that you realize the complexity and beauty of the natural world, and the other is it stops you wanting to walk in a field ever again because you feel it's genocide. You know, it's terrible. But no, I think one of the things is about looking. I mean, looking at things is vital. I try to look at things. As you can tell, I'm a bit of a gobby fella, but I think listening and looking are absolutely vital, because most people don't look very hard at stuff. And they think life... The other thing is people say, life is so fast today. Never trust anybody who says life is so fast today. The truth is, life is no faster than it ever was. It's just that people are skating really fast across the top. And it stops people concentrating. Because if you look at something really closely, you understand something that you then don't need to study again. Whereas when things are going really fast across the top, you have to keep coming back to it, come back to it, come back to it.
You studied archaeology. Did you work as an archaeologist, Tim?
Well, I use the word work advisedly. I did work on an archaeological dig in Wooler in Northumberland. It was unbelievably cold, but I learned something really fundamental, which was there was an ex-Vietnam veteran there who had the most fantastic gift I've ever seen in a man. He could roll a cigarette with one hand in a force 8 gale. I mean, God, my university days were wasted. No, but after that, I went to work at the Bozen Museum in Barnard Castle, which is a fantastic museum, during the hot summer of 1976, which was archaeologically the most interesting year in British history, because it was so hot that all the crop marks came up everywhere. The archaeology of Durham was trebled in 3 months as we found all this stuff. But the pay was so bad that I couldn't actually afford to drive to work and back and have lunch. It was a choice. So I decided that I was meant to be in the world of rock and roll, because obviously I was destined to be successful.
How were you lured out of the world of archaeology into rock and roll?
It's called starvation. We went down to London, because it's really interesting, wherever you are, it's somewhere else that the gold is, isn't it? So we were in the north, therefore it was quite obvious that if we went to London, it was just going to be easy down there. So we went down there because, of course, the roads were paved with gold, and on any night of the week, there were 30,000 musicians better than me there. So we ended up on Social Security and driving a minicab, which was a very salutary experience. And then I struck very lucky. My whole life is about coincidences. And you heard about the pig. That was the first thing. The pig took me down the latter course of my life. The first part of my life was steered by kicking someone very hard in a game of football on Clapham Common. I kicked him very hard, and then someone just happened to mention, as he was writhing on the ground, that he was a sound engineer at Abbey Road Studios. So I suddenly became very solicitous for his well-being. And that led to me being invited to go and record at Abbey Road, and that led to getting record deals, and then that led to a few hit records, and then that led to my hating music, and then going to Cornwall and meeting a pig, and then, you know.
Yeah, I'm just struck with the fact that most people who go into archaeology rarely leave it unless they've got a bad back or bad knees. But then the world of rock and roll beckons, and then suddenly you're helping create hit records. Why would you leave that world then? What took you out of that world? Because it wasn't clearly starvation and poverty, because you became very, very successful in that world, Tim.
I hated it. The people are dreadful. I mean, honestly, I don't know whether any of you... This is actually really the wrong place to be saying this, isn't it? The WOMAD Festival. But, you know... most of the people in the popular music industry are rather disgracefully louche. And there's something repulsive of men over 50 trying to enjoy popular music as well. I know, I've done it. You know, I just don't like the sound of it. No, seriously, it is a horrible business, and it's full of crooks. And I just decided one day, as well as having a fear of flying, which didn't help, I was flying all over the place, I was drinking like a fish, and it just felt seedy. And actually, if I was being really honest about it, when you love something, and I really love music, when you have to turn it into your living, and then to do it, to be popular, you have to do things that is not actually how you hear music, you actually feel it's a bit of a betrayal. That sounds a bit heavy, doesn't it? And that sort of made me think, actually, I should quit the music industry. And I ended up in Cornwall, which is ridiculous. It's 280 miles away from London. I'd never been there before in my life. It's crazy. But, I mean, these things happen.
So that brings us to the Eden Project. I've not been there, but my understanding is that you've created it so that you the sense of arrival has enormous drama to it. Can you describe what happens to people who arrive at the Eden Project, how they arrive at it?
Well, it's a really, really big hole, and you cannot see what's inside until you're right on the lip of it. And that was the idea, that you shouldn't see it from afar. It's the opposite of a cathedral, because a cathedral is meant to be on flat ground so that it goes high, so people can be in wonder at what they see in the distance, whereas this you can't see until it's like a pearl in the bowl of the oyster.
So did you see the site first and the idea came from that? Or was the idea, was it present in your mind and then you went looking for a site for such a thing?
We were hunting for the site. Yeah, I have seen every single hole in Cornwall. No, I have. I have. And the moment we saw this one, you just knew it was the right one, because most of the holes in Cornwall have got a hole and then they've got like a bit which where you hemorrhage in from the outside, whereas this one has got a perfect lip so that you can read the telemetry of it. It's got a perfect edge, so it does feel like a lost civilization is possible inside it.
What was it when you first saw it, this hole, this quarry?
It was a clay mine. It was called a teaspoon mine because the clay inside it was very, very valuable. It was used in fine art papers. It was just coming to the end of its life. So we bought it from the company that had it.
How did you see the potential in it? Because I've seen photos of it before you even built on it, and it looks like a great big, complicated, muddy clay mine. It's not at all obvious, the potential of that place.
No, but the truth is, there is nobody aged 12 who did not dream of building a Mad Ludwig castle, a big dam. That's what you do as a human being when you're aged 12. So it wasn't a huge leap, it was a hole. Fill it with something wonderful, you know. Honestly. But that's all anything ever is. You know, you've got to believe in that you can transform it.
Who was it for, in your mind?
In my mind, it was for everybody. It's only market researchers who say, what's your target audience? I mean, if the scientific institutions of the world were any good, they're rubbish. If they were any good, the politics of the world would be different, because all of us would be educated and would believe that we should protect it. And we don't. Therefore, we obviously need new types of institutions, new types of stories which make everybody get it.
Some years ago, I met and interviewed a man called Richard Louv, who I know you're familiar with, who identified a syndrome he called nature deficit disorder in children today, because most of what they hear about the environment is cloaked in guilt and shame, and there's all sorts of reasons for that, as we know. But he said the overall effect it has is that it alienates children from nature, and so there's less tree climbing, less examples of children mucking about in nature, getting lost for the day in the wilderness. I know you say this is for everyone, but are you trying to create that different idea of nature, that different kind of connection with nature, with children particularly?
Well, there's two things there. I mean, Richard Louv is a great writer, a great point. I think playing outside, we all instinctively know to be right. But this brings me to another attack, right? What I hate, and what I hate about the media, I loathe about the media. I despise the media. And I despise it because there is this kind of observers, our job is to observe from the outside as we ourselves corrode society, because all that we wish to observe is that which is wrong. So you actually have an entire society that is living at a time which is better and safer than it has ever been in the history of whole humankind to live. And yet everybody thinks that every stranger is a paedophile, every road has got a terrorist and a crack dealer on it. Even my mother, who lives in Camberley, for heaven's sake, believes there are crack dealers at the end of her lane. Crack dealers couldn't find the end of her lane. And it's just miserable. Get some perspective. We are living at a time which is a time of miracles. And it's being corroded for us because the world hears about the bad stuff. There have been more scientific advances in the last 17 years than in the history of humankind up until then.
This is Conversations with Richard Feidler on ABC Radio. On air, online, and on your mobile.
How does this kind of poisoned public dialogue sort of infect political conversations amongst political leaders in Britain and elsewhere, as you've observed it?
Well, at the risk of being a ranter, I think the word political leadership is now an oxymoron. No, I don't know whether it is the same here, but we deal with a lot of politicians in the projects that we're building around the world. I thought it was a joke. I thought when you saw programmes like The Thick of It or In the Loop or the rest of it, that it was a spoof, like Yes Minister, Yes Prime Minister. To actually discover you're talking to politicians who actually hold the opinion of a journalist more important than the weight of academia or, you know, a moral compass is absolutely extraordinary. I mean, leadership is about being able to describe the sunny uplands to which we might ascribe or aspire, rather. And you don't see any of that. I'm delighted with Trump. I can't tell you how much I love that man. You know, I seriously do. You know why? Because we deserve it. I mean this. I'm not saying this for effect. I really, really believe that we deserve what we've got because those of us in this room who are wishy-washy liberals like myself didn't fight hard enough with the language we needed to use that was muscular and factual. And I think actually maybe Donald Trump is going to be the most extraordinary thing because I think an awful lot of people are going to say, the guy's actually mad. And then you have to define what you believe in a solid way rather than just touchy-feely stuff. And that may be actually what we need. I know that sounds an odd thing to say, maybe, oddly, but you know. Gay and I, my partner, we went to Thailand and there was this woman who had produced The Simpsons for 25 years. And she was supposed to be a Hillary Clinton fan, and she just laid... There was several billion pounds of philanthropy in the room, and she just laid waste to them and said, I love you, Americans, like me. Remind me how many of your boys died on the fields of Vietnam and Iraq and Afghanistan. What she was basically saying was, it's really nice when you go to Harvard and Yale and Princeton and MIT to talk about owning a country, but if you don't get your hands dirty and you don't go and visit the people who you claim to represent and then like to package them up and where we're operating in politics is something that's done to you. It's really interesting that we do live by politics at a distance, and I don't know many people who get their hands dirty, and I think actually democracy, we have believed, is about a vote, and that's a terrible mistake. It isn't about a vote, it's having the information on which to vote. And I think that if we took some time to look at the countries we live in and what we actually need to do and learnt about what we need, we wouldn't have these demagogues preaching at us. If you drive into Wales, there's a piece of graffiti on a wall somewhere just as you go over the bridge which says, some open mines should be closed for repair. You know, but it's really interesting. It's really interesting. I wonder how many of you in the audience have ever asked yourself this question. What do I feel passionately about that I know nothing about? And the answer is probably almost everything. No, it's the same for me. I mean, I'm not trying to be on some superior higher ground. But then you ask yourself, where did I get those ideas from? Why do I think that? And, you know, you'd look at me, you probably think I'm an environmentalist, don't you? Well, you probably do. You should do. I mean, you should think that guy, obviously, he cares about the environment. But, you know, you want to know the truth? If I was told I had to spend the rest of my life on a desert island with the environmentalists I know, I'd shoot myself. That sanctimonious, self-serving, I'm right, I know what the planet needs, makes me want to drive a Porsche. Where was I? I got so excited about that.
Well, this does lead to my next question. Given that you're normally so shy and retiring in your points of view, I'm honestly wondering, given your belief in being plain, strong, simple language, somehow, in order to get this project, the EGEN project, off the ground, you had to bring boardrooms of people together from government, from industry, raise money from all sorts of different sources. Did you have to just sit there and keep shtum while they talked about key stakeholders and impacting and that kind of thing? Did you punch yourself in the head as they were talking? How did you manage that, Tim?
If you want to do something big, the first thing you need to know is what you don't know and what you're not good at, and then find people to do those things for you. The world needs dreamers, but the world of money fears dreamers. Therefore, you need to dare to dream and organize to deliver. The sexy win-win combination is dreaming, which is then made hard by showing how you can actually deliver that dream in such a way that people who don't trust dreamers will actually put their money there. And the great joke of it is, and this is the tragedy about dreaming, if you look at the Eden Project, it cost £144 million. We turn over £25-26 million a year. It is a stupid investment. What idiot spent that sort of money getting £25-26 million a year? It's crazy, isn't it? Everybody in the world should have shot us, except this is how crazy economics is. The truth is, we have raised 1.9 billion, billion pounds sterling on the back of the Eden Project for Cornwall. One of the things that people who dream need to understand is economics. And I think, now I'm talking on my feet, one of the things I started to hate about the music industry was people who said they were artists and said they wouldn't owe money and I don't do money. Well, it's pathetic not to do money, because if money is embodied energy that you need to release to make dreams come true, and you don't understand it, it means you're an amateur and you don't deserve the luck. If you want to win battles to create magic stuff, you've got to understand the rules by which magic is made. One of the things that politicians don't understand, because in my experience, most politicians... And this sounds like I'm being a Gabby Gitt, but I have met very few politicians that I would employ. And I mean that. There are very few that I've regarded as intelligent enough to employ for a real job. You know, looking good in a suit, yeah, maybe, but not actually doing stuff. And the trouble is they always want to please business people because they find business sexy and they don't understand business. So they do this side thing, it costs this, therefore we can't afford it. The issue is the genius of understanding money and being able to dream is understanding the moment at which not only do you know the cost of things, you understand the cost of not doing things. It's at that moment that you can release magic. So if you transform something and it costs you £20 billion, but at the end of it, people are happy, jobs are created, people come and visit, and it creates a huge amount of money, if you were allowed to take all of those things to account, you would invest very, very differently. And in this country and in Britain, you might say it might make a lot of sense to quintuple the amount of money we spend on education, because the result will be, at the end of it, you will save shedloads.
The way you're talking seems like you found the benefit of making a great, big, strong, radical proposal that tends to knock down things and create space where you can create something enormous. The Hagia Sophia in Istanbul, which was Constantinople, constructed under the Emperor Justinian, who said to his architects, build me the greatest building in the world and do it very quickly. And so it was completed in 5.5 years, where, for example, Notre Dame took a century to build. What kind of instructions did you, Justinian of the modern age, give to your developers, builders, architects, in order to create the Eden Project?
Well, the truth is, the landscape architect was given the shortest brief, I think, in history, which was, we want Picasso meets the Aztec, sex on a stick, go.
Picasso meets the Aztecs, sex on a stick, go.
Yeah. That's true. And the architects and the constructors were told that it would open on St. Patrick's Day. We were just told, it will open on St. Patrick's Day. I don't care. Whatever happens, you will open it on St. Patrick's Day. That's true. Because the guys that saved it from disaster were Irish. And I knew that for us to be lucky, it needed to be open for St. Patrick's Day. And we needed to drink a lot of Guinness. No, luck. Symbolism is important in things. Therefore, it had to be done, and it was. We opened on St. Patrick's Day.
When you look at photographs of the Eden Project, you see these two extraordinary bubbles coming out of the side of the cliff, landing on the floor of the pit around it. And it's not until you actually really see a video of it, you realise how super massive these bubbles are. Tell me how you and the designers hit upon this idea of these super massive bubbles to contain the different biomes.
The bubbles were dreamt of because of washing up. The junior architect on the project, we were having real problems because the bottom of the pit was continued to be dug out. So they, after 6 months, the architects were tearing their hair out because they couldn't get the foundations in. And the junior architect was doing the washing up, and he sat down and he saw the soap bubbles had landed all over the bump, you know, on the side of the drying thing. And he went, "Bubbles. Bubbles." And that was the answer. It sounds like we're making it up, doesn't it? It's true. That's exactly how it was.
So they're two effectively gigantic greenhouses. What are the little bubbles made of, aside from the, you know, the hexagonal or octagonal or whatever?
They're made of ethyl tetrafluoroethylene, ETFE foil, cling film with attitude. You can bounce a mini on them. They're really strong. Triple glazed. One man can lift an 11-meter panel. They're brilliant.
Oh, they're not hard at all. They're like, what, like pillows, are they?
They're pillows. Yeah. When you can walk across them and you can squeeze them and fondle them, you do whatever you like with them.
The footage of them, there's a sense of generosity about the place. The feeling that people have that walking through this place, it feels like a bit of a present made just for them.
I hope so. It's a very lovely place. One of the other things that people will notice is there's no advertising. We don't allow advertising on the site. And most people don't notice that, except they know there's something that they've missed. And it's actually really interesting. The only advertising there is on the beer, it does say what beer you're drinking, but that's about it.
Aside from all the beautiful plants in the two different biomes, one is Mediterranean, one is a tropical rainforest, what kind of creatures live inside these biomes?
Creatures?
Yeah.
Well, we don't have creatures by intent. We've got some birds called Sulawesi white eyes that like cockroaches, and we've got some ground-loving quail that also like cockroaches. The Sulawesi white eyes are amazing. They're big breeding population, but they're fantastic. They're like World War II Spitfire pilots. They come in and they do barrel rolls behind a cockroach. They come in and they peck a cockroach in the arse and suck its guts out, just like that. It's unbelievable to watch. But the really cool thing is that our biomes are now full of British birds who realize that, you know, why go on holiday? Why fly 3,000 miles? You know, I mean, the BBC came to do a documentary on the robins in our biomes. But the robins are so laid back, they're supposed to be very territorial and fight, but ours just go, hey, man, you know, Jesus, should we play? Should we just do that playing stuff? And they do all this playing stuff. And the BBC did this documentary, which is hilarious, because these birds that are meant to be sort of biting each other to death, pecking each other to death, they're basically sitting around chatting and, you know, and they go for a snack because there's lots to eat. We've got so many British birds in there that are just adoring it. And some British plants. It's really funny, all this stuff, because this is a really important point, you see, because the brambles that are supposed to be British, no one ever asked them whether they wanted to be in the rainforest. They're in the rainforest, they're thinking, shit, this is good. They go wallop right across the biome, they love it like that. And so you can never tell what a native plant is. And I'm saying that because you may know that there's a really serious point coming with all this. There are some environmentalists who think we should chainsaw down most of the trees in this botanic garden because they're foreign. They've been brought in by humans. They are not of nature. They are God's abomination. This whole kind of fascistic approach to aliens is extraordinary. You get it in Britain as well, you know, Japanese knotweed. Have you heard about Japanese knotweed? All our riverbanks, we have Japanese knotweed. It's a pestilence. We must poison it. We must use broadshot. We must inject it with something. It's a perfectly harmless plant. These are plants. They're quite happy. Have you noticed how us environmentalists lie a lot about how dangerous the intrusive plants are? God, I'm going to get some poison pen letters, aren't I?
I don't know. Well, tell me about the opening ceremony you had for the Eden Project in 2001. Tim, what kind of a ceremony did you have?
Everybody who ever worked on Eden was invited to come with their families and be inside the main biome. No celebrities. We asked the Bishop of Truro to come because we liked him, but we said, would he mind saying something that wasn't religious? And he did. He was brilliant. This lovely poem about us being creaturely and being kind to each other and generous, and he did it in rhyme. And it was really weird because it was very moving and we all felt, you know, a bit sort of misty-eyed. And then the bloody public came. It's terrible. After all these years building this thing, supposedly for them out there, then the public came and you went, oh, don't like the look of them. They're going around our beautiful garden. We don't like that. It was very funny. It was. It was a very funny sensation, a bit like a whole bunch of strangers had come for a party at your house. But we got over it.
So, obviously, you do this to build on that beautiful sense of ownership that the workers had in the place. Is this a part of your style of leadership, Tim?
I don't know. I think I'm just normal. Most of us are at our happiest in good company around a kitchen table. Is that not true? Is that not where we're happiest? Mm. And I think the weird things that happen in life are when we forget that that's what makes us happy. And we start to think there are posh ways of doing things that are better than actually talking around the kitchen table. And we often talk about the leadership style of the Eden Project being convivial, about just conversational. Don't forget that an awful lot of this sort of masculine, let's organize the world to be like an industrial revolution model of, you know, mechanistic hierarchies, is just that. It was for an industrial revolution and it was actually to do with mechanics. And the last time I looked, I think we're creatures. And we're at our happiest when we hunt in packs and we talk to each other and we catch each other when we fall and whatever.
So what are some of the things you ask your workers to do as part of this idea of building a kind of family-type environment sitting across the kitchen table?
We try to create moments where together we close down for 2 days and we spend a lot of time with each other. We talk about what our plans are. There are all sorts of things we do, but I don't really want to go there because the trouble is...
Why don't you want to talk about that?
Because what happens is people write notes and they think that there's a new sort of religion coming over the horizon. People are always looking for a new guru, and I don't want to be a guru. I'm not a guru. I make mistakes every day. I make so many mistakes I don't want anybody to think I have a secret. I don't. I'm just normal.
We'll take it as granted you don't want to start a religion out of this, but it's still a nice idea when it comes to employment practices, though, isn't it?
Okay, well, we like to encourage ourselves to read books that we otherwise wouldn't read and review them on the grounds that most people think they're educated, but most people are dumb shit. And that includes myself. The problem is we like to think we're educated. I mean, it's really... The truth is that most of us, what passes for education is that we've read something clever by somebody else that we hope the person we're talking to hasn't read, so we look even cleverer. Actual thinking, which we all aspire to, creates a lot of work. A good likening to this is when you go home and you're feeling knackered after a hard day's work and you put the television on and you put the controller there and you sit down and it's one of the difficult channels. It's a documentary. And you're so knackered you can't even reach the damn thing to turn it off. So you sit there like a bird in the headlights. And after an hour you go, wow, that was really good. I've just got all this new information. I really loved that. And I think part of what we all need is regular mountain streams of fresh information as opposed to feeding on the tired old crops that we've been feeding on all the time. You cannot move on if you hold on all the time to the views that served you last year and the year before. That is why actually marches about climate change and shouting at people are pointless. They're pointless because at a certain point, you've got to realize you yourself never changed your mind when someone shouted at you. So why is someone else going to change their mind when you shouted at them? It's just not going to happen. Therefore, you've got to find a new story. And I'm really interested in people who've got new stories to tell. Again, going back to this trip to Thailand, it was really interesting seeing my friend Jonathan Porritt, that many of you may know. He's been against genetic modification for 35 years. He's fought it. He's walked through crops and much of it. But for the first time, he said, I'm prepared to think about it now. I'm prepared to think about it. And it's really interesting how shocked everybody in the room was. What do you mean? You know, it was a bit like you're going to do something really criminal. But actually, we've got to learn that our views, our opinions, are not the clothes we have to always wear. And that if we're not prepared to change, why should we expect others to change? Therefore, I think we need to give ourselves a kind of a moment of, let's re-examine all those things. Let's see whether there's something new. And I've been doing that a lot recently. And it's really exciting to realize how many views you can drop, how many bits of your own prejudice you can put in the dustbin.
How many of those have you done for yourself? How much have you changed your mind over things over the years?
Well, most people who know me would actually be really grateful if I stayed on the same view for much longer than a day. But the truth is, I do change my mind a lot because I love listening to clever people. And when you put yourself in the way of clever people, you will often find that a prejudice you had is worth turning the light in a different way. And I think there's hardly anything that doesn't benefit from actually waiting that extra few seconds before you damn it. But maybe that's because I'm old now.
You said you want to set up Eden projects on every continent on Earth. How's that going? What's progress like?
We're building three in China, including the first one in China is four times bigger than the Eden project. And the third one is going to be, I think, double that size. And they're all different. They're not going to look like the Eden project in Cornwall. We said that we would do other Eden projects, but only if they were each one was were culturally specific. So we're building one in Yan'an, which is the where Mao ended the Long March, which is going to be fantastic on the Luce Plateau. One in Tianjin and one in Qingdao, which is the former German port on, between Beijing and Shanghai. We're building, we hope, one in the USA. We've just bought, this is, I can't tell you how cool this is. This guy we know, I threw a gauntlet at him about this, these amazing trees, and he just made a lot of money. In the middle of Sequoia National Park is one plot of 500 acres with two of the biggest trees in the world on it. And I said, if you want to change the world, buy that plot, and underneath it we'll build the most beautiful conference center for 120 people to have conversations about the sort of things you could do. And the guy's gone and bought it. He's just bought it. Cash. Boof. How cool is that? And so last May the 23rd, I climbed the biggest tree in the world. I tell you what, I shat myself. I was so scared. But there were some very strong guys pulling me up. And I got right to the top, and then I realized how far up it was. And then you stroke this tree and you realize it's 3,500 years old. And you realize how stunningly trivial we are. And you feel quite teary. And I feel quite optimistic that we're living in an age when we can actually share those experiences. So we're doing that, and we've got one, as you know, here in Australia. We're hoping to build something in Australia, and it's just, it could be really cool. If Australia was brave, it could be the coolest project in Australia's history.
Well, there you go. There's the instruction. If Australia is brave, it could be the coolest construction in Australia's history. Let's hope we are brave enough. Thank you so much, Tim. It's been such a pleasure speaking to you, sir. Thank you.
I spoke to Tim Smit at Womadelaide. Tim is the co-founder of the Eden Project in Cornwall. And the Australian project that he mentioned at the end there is his proposal for a major complex in Hobart, showcasing Antarctic plants. abc.net.au/conversations. I'm Richard Feidler.
You've been listening to a podcast of Conversations with Richard Feidler. For more Conversations interviews, please go to the website abc.net.au/conversations.